Hi everyone and welcome back to the Transsection Podcast. Thank you so much to those of you who joined us on last week's episode with Elliot Kay. I really hope you get a lot out of that. I always get a lot out of talking to Elliot. He's very wise and lovely person and also knows a lot about business and speaking. This week I'm joined by Jake Edwards, who is the communications assistant at the Mermaids Charity here in the UK. A lot of you probably would have heard of Mermaids Charity before. They've been featured on TV, and in 2020 they suffered a bit of an attack from conservative types. So more about that in the interview. So a little bit about Mermaids. Mermaids has been supporting transgender, non-binary and gender diverse children, young people and their families since 1995. Back at the start, we were a small group of concerned parents sitting around the kitchen table, coming together to share experiences, find answers and look for ways to keep our children safe and happy. Today, Mermaids has evolved into one of the UK's leading LGBTQ plus charities, empowering thousands of people with its secure online communities, local community groups, helpline services, web resources, events and residential weekends. We also seek to educate and inform wider society on gender identity by helping professionals accommodate and reassure gender diverse young people. Over the years, we've seen many changes in the language and understanding surrounding gender issues, but one thing remains the same. Transgender, non-binary and gender diverse children deserve the freedom and confidence to explore their gender identity wherever their journey takes them, free from fear, isolation and discrimination. So I really hope that you enjoy my conversation with Jake today. And it's so lovely to actually connect with somebody from the community who works for one of these charities. Obviously, so much of the work around this subject is, and particularly in Mermaids, was started off by a lot of cisgender parents. But I think it's imperative that work is carried out by some of the community as well. So I'm really, really pleased that so many of the Mermaid staff and team are also part of the community, because it makes for much better, well-rounded support for everyone. So before we start today, please remember to go and follow us on Facebook, the Transsection Podcast, Instagram at Transsection Podcast, and Twitter at Transsection P, and we're also on TikTok at Transsection Podcast. Enjoy. In a time of great change, we're all making efforts to become more ethical, more educated people. The Transsection Podcast interviews people from many different backgrounds to bring different aspects of human rights to life through humour, authenticity and personal stories. We are privileged to get a glimpse into different people's realities and to get first-hand advice and information from people on the front line of great social change. I'm Harris Eddie Hill, inclusive coach, speaker, and educator, and this is the Transsection Podcast. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Transsection Podcast. And today I'm joined by Jake Edwards from the charity Mermaids. Hey Jake, how are you doing?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Tar. Thanks for joining us today. I'm very excited because I've heard loads about Mermaids, and Mermaids have been around for how long?
25 or 26 years now, actually.
Wow. So that's before you were born and when I was very small.
Technically, yeah, they are a year older than me, so could be my older sibling.
That's cool. So Jake, tell us what you get involved with at Mermaids, and what are Mermaids and what do they do?
So Mermaids is a charity that supports trans, non-binary, gender diverse and gender questioning young people up until their 20th birthday. We also work to support parents, carers, family members, and we also are in contact and do training and various bits with any professionals that are involved in young people's care, so any professionals that might come across a trans or gender diverse young person. My particular role in Mermaids is as the communications assistant and social media lead. So I help deal with press inquiries, And I also get the really fun job of running our social media, which most of the time is very, you know, happy and pleasant. It does have its little moments. But yeah, it's for me, it's just so fun getting to connect directly with the people that need our services, the people that support us, and just the generally the trans community. It's really lovely to be directly involved in that.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I mean, I imagine that Mermaids being around for so long, and then particularly that, you know, the invention of social media, those sticky moments are going to happen, and you're going to, Mermaids has found it. And I think particularly last year, because there was so much campaigning last year, particularly by transphobic groups who are trying to limit the access that trans non-binary kids have to sort of care. And, you know, were you around for that? And what was that like? And what happened?
So, yeah, I've been at Mermaids for about a year and a half now. And I will say it was the start of the High Court case, Tavistock versus Bell, which was sort of aiming to limit young people's access to gender affirming care, specifically puberty blockers. And I remember this sort of coming around. I remember the sort of first whispers that this was going to happen. And I think you don't really realize the scale and the impact that it's going to have until you start seeing it happening on social media. You see the young people that are going to be affected by the ruling speaking up and saying that they're scared, that they're concerned, that they've already been on waiting lists for years, and now they might get to the end of that waiting list and find out that they can't get the treatment that they need. And it is scary, it's worrying, because as a trans person, I imagine myself being in that position. If I'd have been lucky enough and self-aware enough to have come to the realization sooner that I was trans, I would have absolutely wanted puberty blockers. And I think it, you know, potentially would have saved me having to get top surgery. And I think about the amount of time I spent on waiting lists, which was slightly less than people spend on waiting lists now. And that was, it was agonizing for me. I felt robbed of my childhood, because I spent most of my late teens and that sort of really fun, exciting time of growing up and gaining responsibility. I spent that time traveling to medical appointments. So I, you know, I really put myself in the shoes of the people that we're aiming to support. And it feels very heavy and sometimes quite bleak. I think I'm thankful that now there's been a revision on that High Court ruling. So young trans people who have the support of their parents won't necessarily need to go to court to get access to puberty blockers, which I think, you know, it was the peak of sun through the clouds that we really needed at the end of what was, a year-long sort of battling fear more than anything. So yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff gets sometimes a little bit overwhelming on social media. You see, you know, the outpourings of distress, and that's the thing that is the hardest to deal with. It's not just the people that, you know, send in silly comments or are trying to be sort of outwardly hateful. That sort of thing, I think, is easier to roll with, because you understand that most of the time it's misinformation, it's people not willing to understand difference. And I can kind of almost, I sympathize with that, because I think, you know, what a shame that you're sort of limiting your worldview so much that you can't favor love and acceptance over wanting to be right. So that's easy to deal with. It's seeing young people in distress that is hard.
Yeah, because I mean, those are the people that it's actually affecting, right? Those are the people whose lives are being made much more difficult. And I think, you know, a keyboard troll is like, they're fine. They're, you know, they might be miserable people who are interested in kind of controlling other people's lives or making other people miserable. But, you know, ultimately, you know, our focus really is on the people who need that support, right? So Yeah, I think that's important to remember. And I know that for me, if I ever, I don't know if you do this in your job, I don't know if you get involved and you comment on things and you get into conversations with people, but I know that for me, if I ever get involved in conversations, and particularly with people who are transphobic or exclusionary, a lot of the time when I'm typing these things, it's not to change the other person's mind. It's so that people who are scared or feel put down see me typing that stuff and realize that they're not on their own, that there are lots of us who are kind of fighting for what we feel is right.
Yeah, we do. I do see a lot of the people that follow Mermaids kind of get involved and have those conversations. And sometimes it will be one person will reply to a hateful comment that they see on something that we posted. And then it will turn into a conversation between allies and trans people, just sort of supporting each other and boosting each other up, rather than focusing on the hateful comment that was left in the first place. Or it will spark a conversation that is educational. We choose personally not to get involved in these comments because we can never kind of predict the motivations, where these people are coming from, whether they're here out of ignorance and they're willing to learn, or whether they, you know, have some kind of ulterior, like, hateful motive, and that they're commenting purely to bring us down and essentially waste our time. I think that's a key thing, is that we have quite limited time. So we definitely do pick and choose, and we tend to favour the positive over the negative.
That's cool. So what kind of, you know, we know that Mermaids are supporting sort of young trans and non-binary people, but what does that actually look like in practical terms? What is it that Mermaids actually do and spend a lot of their time how do Mermaids interact with people and society, and what kind of work are they actually doing?
So our main sort of the beating heart of the charity is our helpline service. So we have a number that you can call from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday to Friday. We also have an email support service that you can contact us on, and a web chat service, which is really cool. I like that we have a web chat, because it kind of reaches those people that, like me when I was younger, might have a phobia of sort of picking up the phone and having a conversation. So yeah, we have that sort of direct support. We then have our private forums, which are open to young people and to parents. We also have local groups that are run by volunteers, trained volunteers, which are normally in person, but at the moment we've made the switch to doing it digitally over Zoom, which is really cool. Normally we have residential weekends as well, which is weekends where you know, whole families come along to this place and basically do like talks and panels and workshops and stuff. So it's something where people can get involved and they can talk about their experiences as trans and gender diverse people, or they can just be there to enjoy activities and hang out with kids that are like them. And it's also a really amazing journey for the parents, because you see parents come in that are kind of, you know, anxious and they're not sure, and the only trans person they've ever known is their own kid, and they get to interact with these other parents and sort of be a part of this journey, and they come out at the end of it feeling so much more confident and happier. So those are really amazing opportunities when we get to do those. We also have a legal advocacy and support service, which helps people. So for example, if they've been discriminated against wrongly in schools, or they're struggling with things like a name change, then they can go to that support service and they'll sort of help out and give guidance. We have a trans inclusion in sports sort of project that we're running at the moment. So we're trying to get in contact with as many grassroots sports clubs, school clubs, anything, to get them to sort of refine their trans inclusion policies to make sure that it's, you know, down on paper, that these places definitely understand how to support trans and non-binary people within their sports. So that's really cool. there's just so many other things that we do. It's like this huge long shopping list of stuff. So I won't go into like every single thing, but that's kind of our sort of main touch points.
Yeah, that's cool. Obviously, there's been so much in the press recently about trans people taking part in sports. And, you know, a few people have asked me that over the last few years, and it always just drives me mental because I'm like, trans people have been around for a really long time. And just because there's this sudden panic about it, and just because for most people it's the first time they've ever thought of it, it doesn't mean that it hasn't been regulated and fine for years and years. And you know, I've had people come up to me and say like, oh, well, what about when trans people want to start taking part in sports? Like, how do we manage that? And I'm like, we already do. And it's already managed. And we already understand how that all works and what's fair and everything. And it just drives me mental that people think that because this is the first time they've heard of it, this must be the first time this conversation's been had. And it, you know, I'm like, it's all fine. There's this whole media panic about it as if we haven't been taking part in sports the whole time. And guess what? It's fine. And you know, it's always trans women that get absolutely thrown under the bus in these conversations, and trans girls, which, you know, obviously trans misogyny is like possibly arguably one of the worst types of transphobia. And, you know, as I've said to people before, like, you know, typically once if a trans woman has been on HRT for 2 years, then she biologically is kind of at this, you know, within the same bracket as cis women, and she hasn't got an advantage and all this sort of thing. But you know, what do mermaids do? Like, you know, what, and would you have any more to add to that conversation about trans people taking part in sports and how it's all fine and nobody's head's gonna fall off? And
yeah, I mean, I think it's quite interesting, just to touch on the trans women in sport, is that the conversation is always dominated by the idea of we must ban trans women from participating in sport in order to keep cis women safe. But there is never that conversation happening sort of in the other way of we must ban trans men from participating in sport because the trans men will be unsafe if they participate against cis men. Which is kind of, you know, interesting to me, because if you're after protecting a group of people, but in this conversation that they're only talking about protecting cis people, there's no, well, we have to ban these people because that will protect the trans people who would also be considered by us at risk within that sport. I just think that's an interesting thing that always comes to my mind when I'm reading these headlines. Is that, you know, trans men, and I won't even talk about how non-binary people are just not mentioned in this conversation at all. I think, I mean, when it comes to grassroots level sport, and that is sport that is just, you know, mostly for fun or, you know, a sort of low stakes competition, there really is no reason to be excluding trans people, especially when we're talking about kids getting involved in sport. You know, there's absolutely no reason to be limiting children from participating in sport. And in fact, limiting kids' access to sport is, to me, feels like a violation of human rights, because you feel like you should have a right for kids to access sport and exercise, because that is something that keeps young people healthy, and that's a really important thing. You know, it can be quite difficult to get young people active and involved in sport in a way that is exciting to them. So to put any kind of barrier in the way of that is really putting a barrier in the way of their health and well-being. And this is not just physical, it's mental as well, and it comes down to the mental health benefits of exercise, the, you know, releasing endorphins, and also being social, the social development of being part of a team. there's so many things about taking part in sport that is so important. And to think that you would take this small thing and say, well, that means you can't do this because we don't understand how to fit you into our categories. To me, it seems so ridiculous that would be a thing. So yeah, that feels a bit bleak, but
I agree though. And the thing is, like, you know, I used to box, and I've said this to people before, but you know, I'm over 6 feet tall and I currently weigh over 100 kilos. If you're listening in America, that's like well over 200 pounds. And I'm a pretty solid person. You know, if you try and knock me over, I just won't move. And, you know, I haven't even started transitioning yet. And, you know, no extra testosterone has yet to interact with my body. And yet, when I was boxing in a room full of, like, I don't know, 60 people, I was one of the heaviest and tallest people, you know, of any biological sex, gender, whatever. And most of the time I was training with men who were in my weight category, you know, and, you know, a lot of the time we were really thumping each other. And when I was told, oh, you know, you should train with women, like, you know, go and train in a special women's group, I was like, first of all, that's misgendering, and I'm not really keen on that. I'd rather not. And second of all, these women are all a foot shorter than me. And at least, you know, most of them were, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 kilos lighter than me. So I'm like, this is not appropriate, you know. And it made more sense to me that I would be with people within my ability. You know, obviously I was an amateur, and within my weight and height category, like, that was a much fairer fight. And the first fight I had was against somebody who could pack a punch, but she was a foot shorter. And we were in the same weight category, but I still felt like, you know, but we were built differently. And I did feel that I had an unfair advantage, and yet we were considered the best match out of the whole group of people. And I think I would have been better matched with a bloke who was the same size as me. And it just seems mad to me. I just think it makes much more sense to me to be matching people in competitions with ability and maybe weight or something like that. I don't really know. And also, I feel like this whole conversation, a lot of the kind of concern trolling that people are doing online, a lot of it is basically saying, you know, cis women aren't very good athletes. So we really need to make sure that we're not giving people, you know, assigned male at birth this advantage, because, you know, women aren't really very good. And I, you know, constantly I'm like, if you have, you know, by the time we're talking about athletes, they're all amazing and they all win within kind of split seconds of each other, you know, and by the time we're talking about that, like, these sort of cis women athletes that we're so concerned about would kind of beat any of us in anything. Like, they're that amazing. And I still think that so much of this concern, I don't know what you think, Jake, but I still think so much of this concern is based in and rooted in misogyny, and this idea that cis women athletes are just a bit crap and that they need protecting because they're not very good. And I that makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think it, you know, it is quite apparent that a lot of this is misogynistic. And I think people just get confused about, like, misogyny and trans people, and they think, I don't even know what they think, I guess. It's all just so, if it's so see-through, it's transparent, the arguments that people are making against trans people in sport. And, you know, sport that relies on weight and height is already separated by weight categories, right? So you've got things like boxing that is, you know, the people that you're competing against fit weight and height. But, you know, things like football aren't really massively dependent on your weight and your height. You know, you can be good and excel at that sport, you know, regardless of your body type. And I think there's just this big confusion between separating out on weight and height and separating out on sex. And I think I've read somewhere multiple times, and I can never word this in a sort of succinct way, but the similarities between talking about sex between men and women, there are more similarities between men and women biologically than there are similarities between men and similarities between women. So you get sort of more overlap in the middle than you get sort of extremes on either side. So it would make so much more sense if we're just talking about sex, it would make so much more sense to have mixed sex teams anyway, and do those based on weight, height, and ability. And I think that is, you know, where that is relevant and would potentially pose a danger to someone, that is already happening. And I think people just want to take it to an extreme, or use that as an excuse to discriminate against trans people and try and force trans people out of sport. I think the reason that people will read these conversations that are happening about sport and not really know where they stand and feel bad about it because they support trans people is because they're using what is what can be a rational argument in the right setting, and they're putting it with this sort of trans lens on it, which kind of makes the argument irrelevant. They're using really clever tactics in the way that they talk about sport, so it appeals to people that don't fully understand sport or trans people. So if you're not an expert on gender and you're not an expert on sport, you would read these headlines and think, okay, I'm not actually sure what's going on here, but I think I support this thing, I think I support that thing. So it's a really kind of clever way of kicking up a big fuss and taking advantage of the fact that people don't know about trans people and they want everyone to feel safe. I don't know if that's making any sense or if I'm just rambling now.
I get you. Yeah, I think it you know, it is taking advantage a lot. And I think we could kind of circle this back to the whole, you know, hormone blockers and that being made more difficult, because, you know, so much of the conversation, like, I can't remember if it was involved in I don't know if it was involved in J.K. Rowling's essay, but, you know, there's been mention of hormone blockers being dangerous and we don't know the long-term effects, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, but they've been around for decades, decades and decades. And so far, I don't know that we know of a single issue. I don't know if I've heard of a single thing. And I've met loads of people who've used them. And in fact, I think a family member of mine, you know, she must be in her 50s now, but I know that when she was a child, she had early puberty, like way too young, way, way, way too young. And, you know, they use hormone blockers then. I'm pretty sure it's been around for a long time. And so far, nobody's grown a third leg. Like, they've been able to, you know, have children, or, you know, like, there's been all sorts of, like, as far as I know, there's no issue. And yet people are so, I don't know what's happened, but I do feel like within the last couple of years, you know, the media and the general population are starting to get so involved in trans issues and have all these opinions of things that are very well established and that are not an issue. And I don't know if you have any feeling about why this stuff is coming up at the moment, or if this is just a natural reaction to trans people kind of claiming their space.
Yeah, I definitely think that, you know, a lot of the issues that we have had in sort of mainstream media within the last 5 years has been because of an increase of visibility. You know, we've seen, you know, more representation of trans people over the last sort of 5 to 10 years on TV and in film and in other types of media. And through that, we've seen trans people coming forward and saying, you know, this isn't quite accurate representation, so let's start getting the education involved. And I think it was a mix of those two things that has led people to be fascinated by trans people. And I say that as fascinated in a strange way. Yeah. And then that has led to, I guess, this sort of big shift in attitude towards being more negative. I think in terms of puberty blockers, you know, yes, puberty blockers have been used to treat precocious puberty for quite a while. And it is now, because puberty blockers are being used for trans kids, and certain people have decided that they don't like the concept of somebody being trans. They've come after this under the guise of caring for children. And the thing that I think the reason we were so shocked by the ruling against young people being able to access puberty blockers is that it undermines Gillett competency. And Gillett competency basically states that, you know, if a child is aware and educated and competent enough to make the decision about their healthcare, then they can. And they can do this for, this has come into use for things like contraception. So people sort of, even under, I think it's under 16, can consent to taking contraceptives if they are Gillett competent. And if it's deemed to be, you know, appropriate for them to be taking that. Basically if they need to. And so when it comes to trans kids, so they are Gillett competent, they have been assessed, and they can and need puberty blockers, but now they have to go to a court to obtain that. So they have to appeal to a board of people who are not medical experts, are not experts on trans people's experiences, are completely removed from both of these things. And a young trans person will go and have to plead their case to get access to medical treatment. This is just completely not seen in any other sort of medical treatment. There's nothing like this. And it's just completely mind-blowing that this has been allowed to happen. And I think it is happening for the wrong reasons. You know, people can say that they're not happy with the way that gender clinics are running, that they think they're underfunded, the waiting lists are too long. I mean, that's true. You know, we know that gender clinics are underfunded, but if they want more robust care and shorter waiting times and, you know, just a deeper, better quality of care for trans people, the answer is not to take things away. The answer is to put more money into gender clinics, put more money into research and understanding. And that'll mean that trans people's care will not only be more timely and more effective, but just generally a more positive experience for people. I think that's, I feel like I'm going on a big rant right now. You know, when you've been on waiting lists, you get quite sort of infuriated by this kind of thing.
Well, this is the thing as well, and I just think, like, if you need hormone blockers, then, you know, not having them, like you were saying earlier, I mean, I don't know if you want to kind of introduce kind of what your journey was, and the fact that, you know, you've had to wait such a long time, and it's meant that you know, you've gone through things that could have been avoided, you know, so it's kind of made things more complicated. And I was talking to a friend the other day who's been waiting for chest surgery. And originally they wanted buttonhole surgery, which has been explained to me, where they kind of keep, if you're small chested enough, they kind of keep the nipple intact and then kind of do the surgery around that. So you kind of maintain, you know, a lot of the tissue that doesn't get moved or anything like that. And they were saying that they've been waiting so long and they've been binding their chest for so long, that type of surgery is no longer a possibility for them because their chest has changed so much because they've had to bind for so long. And so now they don't have the option of kind of keeping sensitivity or keeping as much of their original kind of tissue intact before kind of getting top surgery. So now they have to have a kind of top surgery that they didn't want in the first place, but now it's kind of narrowed their options because they've been waiting for so long. And you know, and I think about, you know, I got referred 4 years ago, and I'm still waiting for my stuff. And I think, like you say, the lack of funding and everything, like the answer is not to be like, oh well, you're not well funded and people aren't getting the care, so really we should maybe like step away from this or not do it. It just seems like the most strange solution when it's not really, it's, you know, you're, they're basically saying, oh well, in order to deal with this we should make it worse.
Pretty much, yeah.
But, what was it like for you going through all of that?
Well, so I sort of first came to the realization that I was trans when I was about 16. I'd moved from an all-girls school into a mixed gender college. And I guess I'd never really actually genuinely been aware of my gender and who I was as a gendered being. That entering into that space was kind of a shock for me. Because I'd grown up with two older brothers, and then I'd grown up surrounded by girls, and I guess I saw my brothers as boys. I never saw them as, you know, they played with the boy toys and I played with the girl toys. It was just, they had their stuff, I had my stuff. That was theirs, that was mine. And it was more of like an ownership thing rather than like a gender thing. And then when I was in girls' school, I again, didn't see myself as like them, but I didn't always, you know, it was just hard to relate this to gender. It was just a, oh, I'm in this clique and they're in that clique and it's all just about fashion at the moment. And I guess that's how I perceived gender, through this kind of weird lens. And then I go into an environment where I'm seeing people coexisting, and I'm starting to understand more and more how I don't relate to or feel at all like the girls that I was surrounded with, and that I was connecting a lot more with the male experience. And it really quite quickly came to that realization, because I was just sort of finally in a space that was, you know, there was the freedom as well. There was being apart from all the people that I'd grown up with. So yeah, it came on sort of like, oh, it sort of clicked, and I was like, oh, that's why I felt strange this whole time. But yeah, then I went to my GP and I asked for a referral. At the time, you had to go for an appointment at CAMHS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, to get a mental health assessment. And I went through that quite quickly, one appointment. Then they referred me on to the gender clinic in Exeter, which meant I had to travel 2.5-3 hours to get there. And I was, you know, young, didn't have a job, didn't have access to money. So it got really hard really quick. But when I came out to my mum at the time, she wasn't very supportive. So sort of from that point onwards, I was kind of just on my own through the whole journey. I did actually go to the Tavistock for a while. And I was almost at the end of the assessment period, but I turned 18 and I just sort of got dropped through the services. I kind of like fell through the cracks between the kids and adult services. So I had to go back to my GP and ask for a re-referral to the adult services, and basically started again. So I lost about a year and a half's worth, which it was really tough. And the worst thing was when I finally got to the adult clinics, I had a partner at the time and he was also trans, and we got referred to the same psychotherapist, and he had his appointment a month before mine, but she realized in this appointment that she was due to see me, who was dating him, and she decided it was a conflict of interest and she didn't want to deal with two people who were dating. So I then had to wait an extra couple of months to be seen by a different person, which pushed me back again. And then I finally got seen. And then I, the person who saw me for my first two appointments quit, so I had to see another person. So it basically, it was just a huge, massive, rocky road to get to treatment. And when I finally went on testosterone, they put me on injections. But then my doctor at the time decided he didn't like putting people on injections because I was also transferred doctors midway through. He was just not a fan of people getting injections. He favored gel. So against my wishes and without my consent, he changed my medication to gel, which I really didn't get on with. And then I finally got top surgery about 4.5 years. Oh wait, no, it was about 5 years later after my first referral. Yeah. And that was great. I loved top surgery. It was awesome. But I was struggling so much with gel that I just decided to come off it. And at that point, I was quite happy. I had facial hair, a low voice, and top surgery. And I felt sort of physically quite content. And the aggravation I was experiencing from having to apply gel daily, I find it really difficult to do something every day like that. And you know, to have to sit there and not shower and wait for gel to dry wasn't me. I was just way too like up and active. I just wanted to like get up and out and carry on with my day. So essentially that's kind of my start to finish journey. But I think sort of in between getting testosterone and getting top surgery, I realized that I was actually non-binary, which was pretty cool. It was fun. It was scary at the time, and I'm not sure why I was so scared of coming out again, because I'd already come out like 6 different times with my sexuality, because I really was just like bouncing between labels, and the way that I was feeling was sort of developing and changing. And it was a really, it was quite a lovely journey actually to be on, to sort of discover and rediscover my gender and sexuality. But I think just coming to the realization that I was non-binary, I was mostly scared because I didn't want the gender clinics to find out and then not give me the treatment that I needed, because it was kind of known at the time that the gender clinics didn't know how to deal with non-binary care, and that they really struggled to like recommend non-binary people for top surgery. It was just something that I'd heard. So I kind of kept it to myself until after top surgery. But at that point I was discharged from the clinic anyway, because I've kind of gotten to that point in my journey.
That's good. So you've not been on any HRT since you gave up the gel?
Pretty much, yeah. And that's been about a year and a half now, which is weird.
That's nice though. It's nice that I think you can get to a point where you're like, yeah, this will do. This is all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I look forward to that. And I think as well, being non-binary, it's maybe, I mean, I think it's different for everybody anyway, but I think being non-binary is much more of a feeling your way in the dark until you're like, yes, I think this is pretty good. And it's not necessarily that, you know, that that black and white. And I know that for me, like, I've had these moments where I'm like, oh, well, you know, on the occasions that people call me a dude or something like that, I'm like, oh, I really didn't like that. And I've had a couple of people say like, oh, are you sure you're non-binary and you're not actually just a guy? And I'm like, no, definitely not. Like, isn't that's definitely not there either. Like, but when people are like, how do you think you should look? Like, in your mind, what are you supposed to look like? And I'm like, well, it's sort of a bit like this and a bit like that, but I don't know that I'll know it until I see it. And then I'll go, yes, that's right. And I don't get much gender euphoria now, but on the very rare occasions that I get a glimpse of gender euphoria, it's normally like how I'm dressed or something, and I'll catch a certain glimpse in the mirror where I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen myself, but it doesn't happen very often. So was it the same for you, that you were like trying to kind of find your way with Euphoria and like look for the things that felt right? Or did you know already like kind of what you're aiming for?
I think I always kind of knew what I was aiming for in terms of a medical transition. And I don't think my feelings towards my medical transition really changed very much. I think the only change was getting to a point where I felt confident enough to not be on testosterone and for that not to emotionally affect me. Because the one main thing about coming off testosterone was, of course, my periods returning. And I think that was quite distressing and did cause me a lot of dysphoria and still does. But I think, you know, sometimes you get to these points when you're non-binary where you have to weigh up your options of which one makes me feel more dysphoric, which one is the most inconvenient, and sort of go with that. And whilst periods were horrible, the inconvenience of being on testosterone gel managed somehow to outweigh the inconvenience and dysphoria of having periods, which is probably the only thing that really has changed in all of that time in terms of that sort of physical aspect. But the way I look now that I've been on testosterone and had top surgery is everything I wanted from pretty much the start of when I realized that this was something that was possible, something that a person could be. And it's only really my feelings about my gender, the way my feelings relate to my gender, that has kind of changed, but not in like a huge scary way. I think people get quite scared when you say like, oh, I changed my mind about my gender, or I changed my understanding of my gender, because, you know, there's that sort of fear of making an irreversible decision that you then regret. I don't think I've made any irreversible decisions that I've regretted in any way. And I feel quite thankful for that. But I think I must have always known deep down that I was non-binary. I think it was more just about when I was first coming out and first wanting to go on testosterone, there was like a real overcompensation of masculinity for the sake of passing. And I think I was a lot happier being seen as male than I was as female. So it was really this, so if I'm not female, that means I am male. And that means I must be a manly dude. Like I must be like, ooh, like, sports and ooh, pink. and like you wake up one day and you're like, what am I doing? Like, I can relax now. I can just be myself. But it was being on testosterone and finally seeing a reflection of myself in the mirror that gave me that confidence to be like, why am I adhering to these gender roles? It doesn't make any sense. I'm holding myself to such a weird gender standard. Yeah.
That's cool. How do you feel being read as male sometimes compared to before being assumed female when you're non-binary? Is it easier this way?
Definitely, yeah. I think I'm quite lucky because I, as a non-binary person, I definitely think I sit quite far towards male. Definitely not 100%, and sometimes it sort of changes and slides sort of up and down the scale. But I am quite comfortable with people assuming I'm a man. I'm quite comfortable with people using masculine language around me. And in some cases, I prefer that. Like with my family, I prefer that they refer to me exclusively with he, him pronouns and in that kind of male way, because I think there's something about that setting that kind of puts me on edge. And I think I feel more validated and more comfortable with my gender to be seen by them as male. But I think I think being non-binary to me, it's kind of like a little nuance of gender. And I'm quite comfortable with that. And I do, it is such a privilege, I think, being, you know, a kind of androgynous, trans masculine, skinny white person. You know, I fit kind of all of those stereotypes that you hear of sort of trans masculine non-binary people. And I think because of that, I am often read as male. Unless people know what non-binary is, sometimes they'll look at me and think, chances are you're non-binary. But yeah, I think I'm lucky to be happy being seen as male in a society that doesn't understand anything outside of male and female.
Yeah, that makes sense. I often wonder if I'll have like real euphoria in the same way of being like, oh yeah, I probably look a bit more boy than anything else. I think there might be something in there, but I feel really excited when I look at people like Jonathan Van Ness with makeup on, or, you know, Sam Smith with makeup on. I'm like, yeah, or, you know, even older pictures of David Bowie or like Freddie Mercury doing drag and stuff. I'm like, yeah, I like that vibe. It's that little vibe of like, and I get it as well when, like, if I'm not wearing any makeup and I'm out in public and it's not obvious like what my body shape is or something and people look confused, I'm like, yeah, I've hit the spot. When people aren't sure, that's how I want to feel every day. But I think it's so difficult, isn't it, when you've kind of got the option between kind of going more towards estrogen or more towards testosterone. I almost feel like there needs to be a third hormone, like for non-binary people, that isn't, you know. And I'm in a non-binary support group with the gender clinic at the moment, and quite a few of us have said we want to take hormones to be less the thing that we are, but not necessarily more of the other thing. We're trying very hard to strike some kind of middle ground, and that's quite difficult to do.
Yeah, I think it's balancing something that gives you euphoria with something that gives you dysphoria, you know. You're sort of picking between two extremes, and that can be quite difficult. But something that gives me a lot of gender euphoria is mixing sort of hard masculine, hard feminine things, like things are that are considered exclusively masculine, things that are considered exclusively feminine by society. When I see reflected in myself an even combination of those things, it does give me that like little spark of, ooh, that's it, that's the moment. And I think for me it is when I've got, you know, when I've grown my beard out a bit, sometimes I'll fill it in with brown mascara and then I'll put like the brightest eyeshadow on and go like really hard with the makeup. And it's that to me, I see that in the mirror and I'm like, that's awesome. And when I wear a dress and I've got hairy legs, you know, I mean, it's not, there's that thing with body hair, right? Where it's like, women still have body hair, but it's not reflected in, you know, mainstream media. Society doesn't associate body hair with women because of these unrealistic expectations. So you do kind of, I think for myself, I do associate my body hair with a masculine thing. And I think that's definitely something I need to challenge. But it's the perception of myself, my own body hair on me, feels to me masculine. And I try not to let that be the way that I see other people and body hair, because that's, you know, challenging gender roles and it's all of that. But you know, it's that kind of thing for me. My own perceptions of what for me feels masculine and feminine, to mash those up is just awesome.
Yeah, I get that. I relate to that a lot. Jake, it's been so informative to talk to you. If people are looking to get in contact with Mermaids and look for some support in like supporting their kids and stuff, what's the best way for them to get in contact or find you?
Best way to find us is by going to mermaidsuk.org.uk. You can find our contact details if you wish to get in touch with us via our helpline or web chat. You can also find links there to our social media and to the work that we are doing.
Amazing. Any final words for parents or young people dealing with trans non-binary identity?
This is going to sound a bit cliche, but I'm going to say anyway. I think just to take a deep breath and understand that you are not in a race to understand yourself. You don't need to have it all figured out overnight. You don't need to find a label and stick to it. You shouldn't be afraid of change and discovery. And, you know, change is scary for human beings, but it is also so exciting and filled with potential and potential happiness. So yeah, relax. It's going to be okay.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. Jake, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real honour to have this chat with you.
It's been lovely.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. And remember that if you haven't already signed up for our mailing list, please do. It's at muxharrishill.com/transsection. And then you'll get an email when we publish an episode or there's anything else cool going on. We'll let you know about that. Next week, I'm joined by Dean Rasmussen, who is himself a trans guy, also a parent of many, many children and a coach. And he coaches lots of people around coming out and navigating life as an LGBTQ plus person. And he is extremely modest for somebody who is such a wonderful coach and a lovely person to know, and he's doing really, really great work, and it was really fascinating to talk to him. So until next week, stay safe and have fun.